And now to introduce our guest, please welcome Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom.
Thank you much. Good evening, everybody. All right. Favorite. My father was a judge. I never was, so I'll live vicariously with a gavel. And I will officially gavel in and welcome all of you to the evening's event at the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you already know you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Gavin Newsom, Lieutenant Governor of the great state of California, and I'm your moderator for today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Thomas Friedman, the three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist and reporter, the author of six best-selling books, including The Lexus and The Olive Tree, The World is Flat, and his newest work, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. Tom Friedman is known for traveling the globe as he writes about it. He's famous for saying of his travels, if you don't go, you do not know. Mr. Freeman's New York Times career has included stints as Beirut and Jerusalem bureau chief, chief diplomatic correspondent, and later the international economics correspondent. And since 1995, he has been the Times foreign affairs columnist. As a columnist, he's written about finance, globalization, climate crisis, technology, as well as diplomacy, arms control, war, terrorism. I'll end there, but you can continue on. And today he's here, of course, to discuss his most ambitious work to date, in which he contends that we have entered into an age of dizzying accelerations, computing power to self-driving cars, and that this new age brings both new riches and tremendous burdens. Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Thomas Friedman.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a treat to be back in this great theater. Gavin, thank you so much. Gavin and I have been friends since he's been mayor, one of my favorite leaders in the country, and so it's a treat to be introduced by him. And this is really one of my favorite venues. This is such a good book town. So I'm on my book tour now, and it's a real treat to be here with you. I am going to talk tonight about my newest book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. The first question I always get, of course, is, what's the title? What is that about? And the title actually just came out of me one day. I live in Washington, D.C., and I don't like to waste breakfast by eating alone. And so I like to meet with people who I can learn from, so I often have breakfast downtown. And every once in a while, somebody comes 10, 15, 20 minutes late. And they say, Tom, I'm really sorry. This is the weather, the traffic, the subway, the dog ate my homework. And about 3 years ago, my friend Peter Corsell came late and was spilling out apologies. And I just spontaneously said to him, you know, Peter, actually, thank you for being late. Because you were late, I've been eavesdropping on their conversation. Fascinating. I've been people watching the lobby. Fantastic. And most importantly, I just connected two ideas I've been struggling with for a month. So thank you for being late. People started to get into it. They'd say, well, you're welcome. Because they understood I was actually giving them permission to pause, to slow down, to reflect. In fact, my favorite quote in the beginning of the book is from my friend Dov Seidman, who says, you know, when you press the pause button on a computer, it stops. But when you press the pause button on a human being, it starts. It starts to reflect, reimagine, and relearn. And boy, do we need to do a lot of that right now. So the book, I have to confess, began with a complete accident when I paused to engage with someone I normally wouldn't. I live in Bethesda, Maryland, and I take the subway to work about once a week when it's running. Lately, it's been very up and down. And for me, that means driving from my home on Bradley Boulevard in Bethesda to the Bethesda Hyatt, and I park in the underground parking garage, public parking garage there, and I take the Red Line into D.C. where the New York Times has a bureau. And I did that almost 3 years ago now. I went into D.C., went to the office, came back, Red Line, got my car, timestamp ticket, drove to the cashier's booth, gave the guy my ticket, and he said, "I know who you are." I said, "Great." He said, "I read your column." I said, "Great." He said, "I don't always agree." I thought, "Get me out of here." But I said, "Well, that's great, because it means you have to check." And I drove off. And I thought, you know, that's nice that the car guy reads my column. A week later, I took my weekly subway trip, parked the car, Red Line, D.C., back, car, timestamp ticket, same guys in the cashier booth. This time he says, "Mr. Friedman, I have my own blog. Would you read my blog?" I thought, oh my God, the parking guy is now my competitor. What just happened? So I said, "Well, write it down for me and I'll look it up." And he wrote down on a piece of receipt paper, odenambi.com. And I kept it on the seat, and I drove home. As soon as I got home, I looked it up on my computer. He was Ethiopian. He wrote about Ethiopian politics. It was a very, very solid website. And he clearly wrote from a very heartfelt democracy point of view. He's from the Oromo people. And a lot of it had to do with their own role in the future of a democratic Ethiopia. I thought about him for a couple days. I told my wife. And I decided this was a sign from God. I should pause and engage this guy. But I didn't have his email. And so the only way I could do that was park in the parking garage every day. So I kept parking in the parking garage. And it took a few days. We finally overlapped again. And I stopped my car under the gate. And I knew his name now. Eli, I said, "Eli, I like your email. I want to send you a message." And he gave it to me, and that night I sent him a message. I repeat our messages in the front of the book. Some of them are funny. And I basically said, "I have a proposition for you. I'm ready to teach you how to write a column if you will tell me your life story." And he basically said, "I see you're proposing a deal. I like this deal." So he asked that we meet near his work office at Pete's Coffee House in Bethesda. And I was traveling at the time, and I came back, and we did that. And I prepared for him a 6-page memo on how to write a column. And he told me his life story, and it's a great story. He's a student of economics at Haile Selassie University in Ethiopia. And he was blogging on Ethiopian websites, but they were too slow. And therefore, he decided to start his own blog. And now, Mr. Friedman, I feel empowered. His Google metrics say he's read in 30 countries. This is my parking guy. And it's a wonderful story. And he's a wonderful man. And I'm glad I paused to engage him. Well, I then shared with him how to write a column, or how I write a column, because everyone does it differently. And, you know, if the world is a big data set, what I'm about to share with you is my algorithm. This is how I go about organizing it. So a news story is meant to inform. If I write a news story about Gavin's day-to-day in California, he'd say, "You inform better or worse, Tom." But a column, an opinion piece, is meant to provoke. It's meant to produce a reaction. So I'm either in the heating business or the lighting business. That's what I do, okay? I'm either stoking up an emotion inside of you, or I'm illuminating something for you. And ideally, when you really get it right, you do both, and you produce a reaction. Now, to produce a reaction actually is an act of chemistry. You have to combine three compounds. The first is, what is your value set? What do you stand for? Are you a conservative, a liberal, a Republican? Are you a neocon, a neoliberal, a libertarian? Are you a Keynesian or a Marxist? What is the value set you as an opinion writer are trying to promote? Second, how do you think the machine works? So the machine is my shorthand for what are the biggest forces shaping more things in more places in more ways on more days? Because as a columnist, what I'm actually trying to do every week is to take my value set and push the machine in that direction. But if I don't know how the machine works, I either won't push it or I'll push it in the wrong direction. And lastly, what have you learned about people and culture? Because there's no column without people and there's no people without culture. How they affect the machine when it moves and how the machine affects them. Mix them all together, stir, let it rise, bake for 45 minutes. And if you do it right, you will produce either heat or light. And you'll know that by the reaction you'll get from readers. Some will say, I didn't know that. It's a good reaction. Some will say, I never looked at it that way. Thank you. That's a good reaction. Some will say, I never connected those things. That's a good reaction. Your favorite, you live for this. It happens 4 times a year. You said exactly what I felt, but didn't know how to say. God bless you. I want to kill you dead, you and all your offspring. That's a reaction I get. But all of those tell you that you've produced either heat or light. Well, the more I tutored Ayile, we did, I think, 3 sessions altogether at Pete's Coffee House, and I sent him memos back and forth. The more I sat back and started to think to myself, well, if that's what a column is, what's my value set? What have I been promoting all these years? And for those of you who read me, you know that I'm not quite a liberal, and I'm not certainly not a conservative. I'm something in between, and that's because my politics actually comes not from any books of philosophy, but it grows out of the time and place I grew up in Minnesota, a time and a place where politics worked. And so I wanted to explore that a little, and I wanted to explore how I think the machine works today, and I wanted to explore what I've learned over 40 years about people and culture. And so I decided that was the book I wanted to write. And that's what this book is about. So let me just walk you through it briefly. The first part is about the machine. How does the machine work today? And my argument is what is shaping more things in more places in more ways and more days is that we are in the middle of 3 nonlinear accelerations all at the same time with the 3 largest forces on the planet, which I call the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law. So Moore's Law is a proxy for a technology coined by Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, in 1965. It's held up ever since, that the speed and power of microchips will double roughly every 24 months. It's now up closer to 30 months, never mind. But if you put Moore's Law on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. The market for me is digital globalization. Not your grandfather's globalization, containers on ships. That's actually been going down. But everything that's now being digitized and globalized, whether it's Facebook or PayPal or Twitter, all of these MOOCs, everything is now being digitized and globalized. And that's actually what's driving globalization today. And if you put it on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. And Mother Nature for me is biodiversity loss, climate change, and population growth in the developing world. You put that on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. We're actually in the middle of 3 hockey stick accelerations, all at the same time, in the 3 largest forces on the planet, the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law, and they're all interacting with each other. More Moore's Law, more technology drives more globalization drives more climate change, and more solutions, potentially. But these accelerations aren't just changing our world. They're actually reshaping it. And they're reshaping 5 realms in particular. The workplace, we all know that. Politics, we can see that. Geopolitics, we can see that. Ethics, we don't always see that, but I'll explain that a little later. And lastly, community. And the front half of the book is about the accelerations, and the back half is how I reimagine these 5 realms. So let's talk a little bit about how the machine works. I'll just focus on the Moore's Law dimension. And that chapter in the book, I'm just going to get my little clicker here, is called What the Hell Happened in 2007? 2007. sounds like such an innocuous year. What's this guy talking about? Well, here's what happened in 2007. It started here in this city at the Moscone Center. Steve Jobs, January 2007, unveiled the iPhone, beginning a process by which we are now gradually putting a handheld computer connected to the internet and the cloud into the hands of every person on the planet. Well, that's not all that happened in 2007. 2007, a company down the road called Facebook, actually late 2006, opened itself to anyone with a registered email address. It had been confined before that to high schools and universities, and it went global. 2006, a company down the street here called Twitter opened its doors, and in 2007, it went global. In 2007, the most important software platform you've never heard of, although it's based right around here, called Hadoop, named after its founder's son, Toy Elephant, opened its doors. Hadoop created an open source software platform that basically enabled us to connect 1 million computers so they could all act as one. And it helped us really create the foundation for big data. In 2007, a company called GitHub, also around the corner here, opened its doors. Now the world's biggest repository of open source software. In 2007, a company called Google gave us an operating system called Android. In 2007, this company called Google also bought a little-known TV station or an online network called YouTube. In 2007, in the town I was in yesterday, Seattle, this guy named Jeff Bezos came out with the first e-book reader called the Kindle. In 2007, IBM started the world's first cognitive computer called Watson. In 2007, three guys, not far from here again, who were attending the design conference in San Francisco that year, decided to rent out their spare air mattresses for some people who wanted to attend but couldn't get a room at a hotel. And they started in 2007 a company called Airbnb. In 2007, this graph up here, kind of interesting. This is the cost of sequencing a human genome. In 2001, it was $100 million. Then you'll notice it goes over a cliff. And it goes, if you trace your finger straight down, the year is 2007. Goes down to $1,200, basically, today. In 2007, solar power took off, and in 2007, a process for extracting very natural gas from very tight shale called fracking began at scale. In 2007, this is a graph. The white line going down, that's the cost of generating a megabit of data. This is really a graph that reflects social networks. The blue line ascending is the speed at which you could transmit it. The two lines cross in 2008. Close enough for government work. That's what Moore's Law looks like. So in 2007, Intel, I always forget this. In 2007, the cloud was born. The first year it shows up statistically at $5.8 billion in revenues is 2008. It was born in 2007. And in 2007, Intel, for the first time, went off silicon to extend Moore's Law. They introduced non-silicon materials into their transistors. Turns out, friends, 2007 may be seen in time as the single greatest technological inflection point since Gutenberg invented the printing press. And we completely missed it because of 2008. So right when our physical technologies just took off, like we were on a moving sidewalk in an airport that suddenly went from 5 miles an hour to 35 miles an hour, so many of the social technologies we needed to go along with that, to cushion the worst and get the best, the regulatory reform, the social reform, the managerial reform, the learning methods, and our political system basically seized up as we went into the deepest recession we've had since 1929. That's what happened between 2007 and 2008. There was a huge dislocation. Our physical technologies leapt ahead, and politics didn't catch up, and we are still living with that dislocation. My friend Astro Teller at Google X, who runs Google X, I was out talking to Astro one day, and we were talking about this, and he just went over to his whiteboard, and he drew this crude illustration of where we are. That blue line across the middle, he said, that's the average rate at which human beings and societies adapt to change over time. It has a slightly positive slope, but it's very gradual. The white line is technology. So if you lived on the left side of that line in the 11th century or the 12th century, actually your life didn't change at all. Yeah, there was a time, a long time, where nothing changed over a century. And then we got Galileo and Copernicus and eventually Intel and chips, and the line starts to go straight north. And then Astro drew a little diamond there and a little arrow, and he said, we are here. We're now living, basically, at a time and in a place where the change in the pace of change now is so fast that average societies and citizens can't keep up. Then he went over and got another little piece of magic marker, and he drew that dotted line there. And the dotted line he labeled learning faster and governing smarter. And that is our challenge now. How do we lift that adaptation line so more people can live at this rate of change? So how did all this happen? Basically, what I argue in the book is that the computer basically is made up of five parts. The CPU, the microprocessor, the storage chip, the networking, the software, and the sensor. And I kind of tell the history of all five. And what happened, in a sense, is they were all in a Moore's Law, and they all melded together in 2007 into this thing we call the cloud. The cloud. But I don't use the word the cloud in my book because it sounds so soft. So fluffy, so benign. It sounds like a Joni Mitchell song. I've looked at clouds from both. This ain't no cloud, folks. This is a supernova. This supernova is the largest force in nature. It's the explosion of a star. Only this is an ever-expanding and strengthening explosion. And it's now really the center. It's not really the center of our economic life. I mean, where did you want to build your town in the Middle Ages? You wanted to build it on a river, because that river brought you nourishment, it brought you transport, it brought you ideas, and it brought you power. You wanted to build your town on the Amazon. Where do you want to build your town today? On Amazon.com. You want to build it on the flows coming off the supernova. Because what they're doing is changing four kinds of power. And that's what's reshaping the world. They've changed the power of one. Oh my goodness, what one person can do now is staggering. We have a president-elect who can sit in his penthouse and tweet to hundreds of millions of people without any filter or any editor. If that isn't scary enough, though, the head of ISIS can do the same thing from Raqqa province. We've changed the power of one. We've changed the power of machines. Machines can now think. They have all five senses. We learned that for the first time on, of all places, a game show. February 14th, 2011, there were three contestants. Two were the all-time Jeopardy champions, and the third just went by his last name, Mr. Watson. Mr. Watson passed on the first question, but he buzzed in before the two human beings on the second question. And the question was, it's worn on the foot of a horse and used by a dealer in a casino. And in under 2.5 seconds, Watson, in perfect Jeopardy style, said, what is shoe? And for the first time, a computer figured out a pun faster than the two all-time Jeopardy champions. world kind of hasn't been the same since. It's changed the power of flows. Ideas now flow and change at a rate we've never seen before. Barack Obama, 5 years ago, said marriage was between a man and a woman. Today, blessedly so, he says marriage is between any two human beings who love each other. And he followed Ireland in that position. Think how fast these things are changing. And lastly, it's changed the power of many. Because of our amplified powers, we as a collective are now a force of and in nature. In fact, this geophysical era is being named after us, the Anthropocene. So what these new powers are doing is reshaping politics, geopolitics, ethics, the community, and the workplace. So let me talk a little bit about those before we go to questions. So my chapter on the workplace, how it's being reshaped, is called How We Turn AI into IA. How do we turn artificial intelligence into intelligent assistance, A-N-C-E, intelligent assistance, A-N-T-S, and intelligent algorithms so more and more people can learn faster, govern smarter, and live at this pace of change? So let me give you an example of all three. My example of intelligent assistance is the Human Resources Department at AT&T, where I spent some time in writing this book. So AT&T, 360,000 employees, they wake up every morning living right on the edge of the supernova. They compete with Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile, hyper-competitive environment. So their HR policies, in a nutshell, I would describe it like this. They begin every year with their CEO, Randall Stephenson, giving a radically transparent speech about how they see their world, how they see their competition, and what skills you're going to need to be an employee that year at AT&T. Then they put every AT&T employee on their own in-house LinkedIn system. So they've got Gavin Newsom there. Gavin Newsom. They determined that there are 10 skills you're going to need to be an employee at AT&T today. And they come to Gavin and they say, Gavin, you've got 7 of the 10, but you're missing 3. But here's the good news. We just partnered with Sebastian Thrun from Udacity to create nano degrees for all 10. And we will give you, Gavin, $8,500 a year to take those courses. There's just one condition. You have to take them on your own time. If Gavin says, you know, I've actually just climbed up one too many telephone poles. I don't want to do this anymore. AT&T now has a wonderful severance package for Gavin. But Gavin will not be working at AT&T. Their new bargain with him is that if he is ready to take those courses, they're ready to ensure that he'll get the first crack when new jobs open. They won't go outside. That's their bargain. And the underlying message, coming to a neighborhood near you, is that you can be a lifelong employee at AT&T, but only if you're ready to be a lifelong learner. That is the new social contract. And their program is intelligent assistance to enable their employees to do that. Intelligent assistance, A-N-T-S, the example I use is Qualcomm. They took a bunch of their buildings on their 64-building campus in San Diego, and they put sensors on everything. Every door, window, faucet, drain, light bulb, computer, HVAC system. They got sensors on everything. They beam all the data up to the supernova, and then they beam it down on an incredibly user-friendly iPad for their janitors. Their janitors can swipe down. They know if somebody leaves their computer on, if a light bulb goes out, if a pipe bursts, they know it immediately. They swipe down. They've got who to call. They've got the instruction manual there. Their janitors have become maintenance technologists. They now give tours to foreign visitors. Think what that does to the dignity of a janitor, because he's got an intelligent assistant, or she's got an intelligent assistant to help them live above the line. Intelligent algorithm, the example I use is the partnership between the College Board and Khan Academy, the online learning platform. So you know the story when your kids have to take the PSAT exam in 11th grade and the SAT in 12th grade, and if you're neurotic parents like we were, you know, you go out and you hire a tutor, $200 a shot to up your kids' verbal or math scores. a completely rigged game, okay? Because if you're from an underprivileged family or neighborhood, you may not even know about this trick. And if you do, you can't afford it. A completely rigged game. So 2 years ago, the College Board that administers the SATs and Khan Academy created a platform for free online SAT and PSAT college prep. Now my friend Gavin in 11th grade takes the PSAT exam. He gets the results back and they say, Gavin, you did very well on math, but you have a problem with fractions and right angles. It then takes him to a practice site just devoted to fractions and right angles, his exact weakness. If he does well there, it takes him to another site offering college scholarships and another site that says, Gavin, have you ever heard of AP Math? Because maybe no one in your family or neighborhood has ever been in AP Math. You could actually take AP Math. It has another line to connect him with Boys and Girls Clubs of America, which are now providing coaches for these young people. That is an intelligent algorithm, and last year, 2 million American kids participated in it. You would know nothing about intelligent assistants, or intelligent algorithms if you just followed our presidential election campaign. This would all be shocking news to you, okay? Bernie Sanders' big idea was to take apart the banks. Donald Trump's big idea was to take apart Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton's big idea was to direct you to her website, okay? But in fact, there is massive innovation going on in the workplace, in communities, to actually help people live above the line. It just needs to be scaled and shared. Let me talk a little bit about how politics is being reshaped. You don't need it, I got it. How politics is being reshaped. I believe that we're going through right now not one but three climate changes at once. We're going through a change in the climate, we're going through a change in the climate of technology, and we're going through a change in the climate of globalization. We're actually going through three climate changes at once. What do you want when the climate changes? You want two things. You want resilience, because you need to be able to take a blow. It can be very disruptive. But you also want propulsion. You want to be able to move ahead. You don't want to be curled up in a ball hiding under your bed. So I sat back and I thought, who can I go to tutor me on how you build resilience and propulsion when the climate changes? And then I realized, I know a woman who's 3.8 billion years old. Her name's Mother Nature, and she's dealt with more climate changes than anybody. So I invited her for an interview. I sat her down, and I said, Mother Nature, what are your secrets for basically producing resilience and propulsion when the climate changes? She said, well, Tom, first of all, I do all this unconsciously, but I'm incredibly adaptive in a brutal way through natural selection. My rule is only the adaptive survive. Second, she said, I love diversity. I love pluralism. Try 20 different species, see who wins. My most diverse ecosystems are my most resilient ones. Third, she says, I am very sustainable in a very circular way. Everything is food. Nothing is wasted. Eat food, poop, seed. Eat food, poop, seed. I'm very sustainable. Fourth, she said, I'm incredibly entrepreneurial. Wherever I see an opening, I fill it with a plant or animal perfectly adapted to that niche. Fifth, she says, I do believe in co-evolution. I'm incredibly heterodox and hybrid. There's nothing dogmatic about me. I put the right bees with the right flowers, the right trees with the right soils. I like to mix everything up. Nothing is dogmatic. And lastly, she said, I do believe in the laws of bankruptcy. I kill all my failures and take their energy I return them to the great manufacturer in the sky and then take their energy and use it to nourish my successes. My argument is the communities, the countries, and the political parties that most closely mirror Mother Nature's mechanisms for dealing with climate change are the ones that will thrive in the age of acceleration. And so just for fun, I took it one step further in that chapter and invented Mother Nature's political party. What if Mother Nature were running in this election? I won't go through the whole platform, But obviously it's a proxy for my own politics, because I'm on some issues, I'm to the left of Bernie Sanders. I believe in the age of accelerations, we're going to need to strengthen our trampolines and safety nets. The world is going to be too damn fast for some people. I believe we should have single-payer health care. I don't understand if Sweden can do it and Singapore can do it, how we can't do it. But at the same time, I'm to the left of the wall, to the right of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I would abolish all corporate taxes. I'd replace them with a carbon tax, a tax on bullets, a tax on sugar, and a small financial transaction tax. I want to get radically entrepreneurial over here to pay for the safety nets we're going to need over here. But in our system, if you're for safety nets, you're never for entrepreneurship. And if you're for radical entrepreneurship, you're never for safety nets. We don't let what should co-evolve to co-evolve. And that's why all our parties are blowing up. Our parties, the European parties, because these parties were basically designed to answer questions of the New Deal, the Industrial Revolution, the early IT revolution, and civil rights, both racial and gender. And I believe what political parties have to answer in the future are how you respond to the three accelerations, how you get the most out of them, and how you cushion the worst, and that will require a very different hybrid mix of ideas. Let me close by talking about the realm of ethics and why that has to be reimagined as well. So that chapter in my book is called Is God in Cyberspace? Best question I ever got on book tour. 1999, I'm up in Portland. I'm talking about my book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Guy stands up at question time, says, Mr. Friedman, is God in cyberspace? I said, I have no idea. And I felt like a complete idiot. I got home, I called my spiritual teacher, he's a rabbi, Zvi Marks. I got to know him at the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. He lives in Amsterdam, interesting guy, he's married to a Dutch priest. I called him up, I said, Zvi, I got a question I've never had before. Is God in cyberspace? What should I have said? He said, well, Tom, you know, in our faith tradition, we have two concepts of the Almighty. One is biblical, one's post-biblical. So the biblical concept of the Almighty is that the Almighty is almighty. He smites evil and he rewards good. And if that's your view of God, he sure isn't in cyberspace, which is full of pornography, gambling, cheating, lying, terrible talk, and now we know fake news. But he said, fortunately, we have a post-biblical view of God that says God manifests himself by how we behave. So if we want God to be in cyberspace, we have to bring him there by how we behave there. So I put Zvi's answer in the paperback edition of Lexus and the Olive Tree, where nobody ever saw it. And I forgot about it. So 20 years later, I'm working on this book, and I find myself suddenly, retelling that story. And I say to myself, why are you, just one second. Why are you retelling that story all of a sudden? And it became immediately obvious to me. Because everything's moving to cyberspace. Where we do business, where we learn, where we get our news, where we find our dates, where we find our spouse, where we contact our friends and family. Everything's moving to a realm where we're all connected, but nobody's in charge. There's no police in cyberspace. And boy, didn't we see that in this election? Suddenly we saw fake news. Suddenly we saw hacking from Russia of our election. Everything was happening in cyberspace, but that's a realm where we're all connected. But nobody is in charge. And therefore, what values prevail there is going to become an increasingly important issue. And at the same time, because of these amplified powers, individual makers and breakers are now becoming super empowered. And in an interdependent world, that's also scary. What values do they have? Because when it's a great time to be a maker, it's also a great time to be a breaker. When it's great time to be IBM, it's also a great time to be ISIS. So what does that mean? What it means, friends, is we're actually standing at a moral intersection we have never stood at before as a human species. In 1945, we entered a world where one country could kill all of us. And if it had to be one country post-Hiroshima, I'm glad it was ours. I believe we're entering a world where one person will be able to kill all of us, and where all of us will be able to fix everything. The same accelerating powers are creating a moral universe where one of us can kill all of us, and all of us, if we put our mind to it, could feed, house, and clothe, and educate now every person on the planet. We have never stood at this intersection before. Because what does it mean? It means we have never been more godlike as a species. And if we are going to be godlike as a species, we sure all better have the golden rule, or whatever version of it your faith has, and every faith has some version of it. I know what you're thinking. I gave this talk as the commencement address at Olin College of Engineering last May, this part of the talk. And I said to the parents, I know what you're thinking. You paid $200,000 so your kid could get an engineering degree. And there's a knucklehead commencement speaker lecturing about the golden rule. Is there anything more naive that we have to scale the golden rule? Well, I'm here to tell you tonight, as I told them, naivete is the new realism. Because I'll tell you what's really naive. Thinking we're going to be okay in a world with this much amplified power, where so much of our daily life is migrating to a realm where we're all connected and no one's in charge, if we don't scale the golden rule. So where does the golden rule come from? How do people get it? Well, there's just two ways that I know of: strong families and healthy communities. That's where we learn to do unto others as we wish them to do unto us. Well, I'm not an expert on strong families. I hope I built one, but I wouldn't ever deem of lecturing anyone on that. But I do know something about a healthy community because I grew up in one. And that's where the book ends. The last two chapters are about the little town, little suburb really outside of Minneapolis called St. Louis Park, where I grew up, where my values were shaped. It was a freaky place. The short story is that in Minneapolis, all the Jews lived on the north side of Minneapolis with African Americans in the 40s and early 50s. Minneapolis was the capital of anti-Semitism, in fact, and then until Hubert Humphrey became mayor, really cleaned it out of city government. After the war, the world opened up a little, and all the Jews, basically in a three-year period, migrate from the north side to one suburb, the one that didn't have redlining, St. Louis Park. And overnight, this suburb goes from 100% Protestant Catholic Scandinavian to 20% Jewish, 80% Protestant Catholic Scandinavian. If Sweden and Israel had a baby, it would be St. Louis Park, okay? And I tell the story of how we all got to know each other and built an inclusive community. We, the frozen chosen, as we called ourselves, the Minnesota Jews, and these incredible Swedes and Norwegians. And in this explosion between these neurotic Jews and these incredibly decent, pluralistic Scandinavians was built an amazing community. And I tell the story of my high school, Hebrew school, and community because I basically grew up in the same decade and a half with the Coen brothers, Al Franken, Norm Ornstein, Michael Sandel, Peggy Ornstein, Alan Wiseman, Dan Wilson, who wrote Someone Like You with Adele. We all basically grew up in the same time and place in this little suburb. This was not a neighborhood in the Upper West Side of New York. This is a one high school town in Minnesota. The Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man, was about our Hebrew school and our little community. It was an amazing place to grow up, and it endowed all of us with a real civic ethic, because we all grew up watching politics work. And we all, in our own way, tried to bring it to the world. Sandel with communitarianism, Franken with his politics, Norm Ornstein with his theories, me with my journalism, the Coen brothers with their movies, and many others. Last chapter of the book, I go back home 40 years later. Now my high school is 50% white Protestant Catholic, 10% Hispanic, 10% Jewish, and 30% Somali and African American. Because the same suburb that was ready to take the Jews took the Somalis. Well, ain't that now the story of America? Now the inclusion challenge is so much more difficult and challenging. But ain't that the story of America? And ain't that the story of the world? How are they doing? Got to read the book, but pretty good, actually. My friend Amory Lovins, the great physicist and my teacher on all things about physics and the natural world, likes to say, when people ask him, Amory, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And Amory always says, I'm neither, because they're just two different forms of fatalism. One says everything will be great. One says everything will be awful. Amory says, I believe in applied hope. I love that phrase, because what I see in Minnesota, in so many communities around the country, are a lot of people applying hope. They don't know whether it's all going to work, but there's an amazing number of people who want to get caught trying. And that's the source of my optimism. So to conclude, my book has a theme song. I thought, could I buy this? And actually, when you open the book, it would play this song like a Hallmark card plays Happy Birthday. And the song is by a wonderful country folk singer who I like, Brandi Carlile. And the main refrain, the song is called The Eye, E-Y-E. And the main refrain is, I wrapped your love around me like a chain, but I never was afraid that it would die. You can dance in a hurricane, but only if you're standing in the eye. And I think what's going on in America today is we have a politician, because this hurricane, these are the three accelerations I'm talking about. And we have a politician whose strategy is to build a wall against the hurricane. My argument is that you have to build an eye. An eye that moves with the storm, draws energy from it, but creates a platform of dynamic stability within it. That's the healthy community where people can feel connected, protected, and respected. I think the great struggle in America for the next 4 years at least is going to be between the wall people and the eye people. And my book is a manifesto for the eye people. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. Well, a little business first. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. We're talking about how nations and individuals can best cope with what Mr. Friedman terms the age of accelerations. I'm California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. I'm your moderator, and you can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel and follow the club on Twitter and Facebook, all founded in 2007.
You did that really well again.
God bless you. So, it's interesting. All the questions everybody gave me, everyone wants to talk. It's very contemporary in everybody's mind, obviously, about the presidential election. And it's interesting, almost without exception, every single question the audience offered me was around globalization, issues of what's happening with manufacturing, and are we going to get the jobs back, et cetera. But I want to go back. I mean, what you described in your presentation, what you described in the book is this hinge moment of sorts, right? We're going from something old to something new.
Right.
The industrial economy has run out of gas. It's in atrophy. And as you talk about it, something's happening in the plumbing of the world. Technology, economics, demographics, all shifting. Paralysis contrasted by rebirth. One of the questions I get more often than not is, are we overstating these white waters of change? Are we really moving that quickly into this sort of exponential phase, as you describe it in the book, of technology? And in that context, what is the future of work?
I think we are, the way I think about that question, Gav, is that technology always moves up in steps. When we moved to the telegraph, that was a big step. Then we moved to the steam engine or whichever preceded, and then the mainframe and the PC and the desktop. Each one of those is a platform. But what's different from the telegraph was the iPhone. It came out here, and it came out in Nigeria, like a few weeks later. You know, so these things now scale globally at a rate we've never seen before. I think what's unique about this platform, so it's impossible for me to measure contemporaneously how this step up compares to others. But what I do think happened in the early 2000s were two steps up that were quite profound. The first, and they're both driven by a price collapse.
Right.
So the first was a collapse in the price of fiber optic cable. Happened around the late 90s and early 2000s, driven by the dot-com boom, bubble, and bust. We overbuilt all this fiber optic cable. The price collapsed. We accidentally wired the world. And we woke up in the early 2000s and discovered that we could touch people who could never touch us before, and we're being touched by people who could never touch us before. I remember calling home to my late mom in Minneapolis, and she was clearly distracted. I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" She said, "You're disturbing me. I'm playing bridge on the internet with someone in Siberia."
Okay. Siberia.
So suddenly that was new. When people tell me, I always tell people, people say it's nothing new. I say, "Really? Was your grandmother playing bridge on the internet with someone in Siberia?" So I actually came along and wrote a book about that moment. I gave it a name. I said, "The world is flat."
Right.
I didn't mean that borders were disappearing. I meant that suddenly more people were on an equal platform to compete, connect, and collaborate. I actually did that book came out in 2005. I did a 2.0 in 2006. And then I did the 3.0 edition in 2007. And then I stopped. I thought I had it figured out. As my broker says to me, 2007 was a bad year to stop sniffing glue. You know, it was, I stopped thinking, okay, I've got this platform, this stage figured out. That's when I stopped. What happened in 2007 was another price collapse. We had a massive collapse in the price of compute and storage. Because when Hadoop and other and Google enabled us to actually string together 1 million computers to store and compute things as if they were one machine, the price of compute, storage, search, and especially when you can then search unstructured data, boy, that was a new world. Mm. And that's what gave us the automated cars, machines that can think. So again, I'm not saying, I don't know how that compares to the telegraph.
Right.
All I know is that's a pretty big step up. And I think what happened in the last decade and a half, well, you know, my short history of America is, let's go back to the 1950s. So I have a quote from a congressman in Minnesota who talked about growing up in Minnesota in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which we now know is the golden age of blue-collar work, right, where you could get high wages for middle skills and strong union time. We were a giant industrial economy, and most of the world was still recovering from the war. And he said, growing up in Minnesota in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you were a blue-collar worker, an average blue-collar worker, you needed a plan to fail. Yeah. Okay, you actually needed a plan to fail. There was so much updraft of work. I had an uncle who only had a high school degree, and he worked as a loan officer at Farmers and Mechanics Bank in Minneapolis. You know, I really remember that. So what happened then is we then begin the early IT revolution, automation, and globalization. And a lot of people really didn't keep their skills up, but we gave them hammers to build houses, and we gave them mortgages and credit cards. And a lot of people were able to stay in the middle class by really riding up the value of their homes, their home mortgages, and by credit.
Right.
And then think what happens in 2 years, 2007, 2008. 2007 comes along, and suddenly machines start devouring white-collar and blue-collar work like we've never seen before. And 2008 takes away your mortgage. And a lot of people find their homes underwater. And I think the confluence of those two things gave us the Tea Party and gave us the election we just had.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's extend this out. I mean, you were up in Seattle yesterday, and you know, we all read today, or at least some of us read, Amazon just came out with a fully automated grocery store, putting literally at peril potentially 3.5 million workers that are cashiers. That's AI, that's big data, the combinatorial nature of that technology. We've got a company founded right down the block here. Travis comes along with an app and completely you know, usurps the taxi cab industry. There's the paralysis contrasted by rebirth, right? Taxi cabs and Uber overnight. They bought a company, Otto, that just shipped 50,000 cases of beer in Colorado. They're a trucking company, and they're going after 3.5 million people, coincidentally, that are truckers. I mean, how concerned should we be about this tech genie now being out of the bottle?
I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned because it's happening too fast. Again, when people tell me this is not happening fast, nothing new, I say, really? Okay, talk to me in 3 years. So it's happening, I think, faster than our social technologies. Right. This is a concept of my friend Eric Beinhacher at Oxford, because I really like that, the idea of their physical technologies and their social technologies, you know, that need to go with them. But if your physical technologies get way ahead of your social ones, you have a problem. So let me step back and tell you what I think the answer is, because the main thesis at the end of my book is that the proper governing unit for the 21st century, and you have a lot of experience in this, is not going to be the federal government. We still need it for a national bank, for national security. It's not going to be the federal government is simply too slow now at adapting to this rate of change, too gridlocked. Right. It's not going to be the single family, because it's too frail, especially we have so many single parent families. They can't navigate these winds of change. My argument in the book is it's going to be the healthy community.
Yeah.
And the healthy community that's close enough, nimble enough, there's not so much politics. Yes, there's left and right in San Francisco and Minneapolis, but there is, at the end of the day, no Democratic sewer, no Republican electricity. People in the end do tend to compromise. And so these communities are much more nimble at responding to the changes. So that's one thing that gives me succor. The other is that, and the reason the book is called, I could have called this book The World is Fast. Yeah, the world is flat, the world is fast, very cute, you know. I didn't for a reason, because the subtext of the book, Gavin, is that my belief that everything that matters most today, it's all the stuff you can't download.
Yeah, well done.
It's all the stuff you have to upload the old-fashioned way, one human being to another. Mm-hmm. And what I have found in writing the book is how that human-to-human connection is becoming more important than ever. And I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think that's going to spin off millions of jobs we can't imagine. Mm-hmm. So Gavin and I were talking before we came out about a quote in the book from our Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. He's the Surgeon General of the United States, a really amazing doctor. And I was interviewing him, and we were talking, and he said, you know, what do you think is the most prevalent disease in America today? Is it heart disease? Is it cancer? Is it diabetes? And Vivek said, no, it's none of those. It's isolation. I thought, wow, we live in the most connected age, you're telling me, and the biggest disease in America is people feeling isolated and disconnected. And I think there's going to be a huge amount of work around that. We were at Thanksgiving this year with our best friend's family. We go to Thanksgiving and back in Washington with them every year, and their daughter is married to a guy who's a consultant for restaurants. So I just said to him, Daniel, what's new? What you working on? He said, it's interesting. I was approached by a company. They have, I think it's called Paint It, where they have bars now where adults come to do paint by numbers. This is true. You can Google it, as they say. And what it is really, it's really just about social connection. People come together in a bar, they paint by numbers, they have a drink. Now, guess what? I bet there's a lot of jobs now designing paint by numbers for adults. And after you do that for a day, you're probably going to need a massage. So you're never going to see it coming. But what I always remind people, if horses could have voted, there never would have been cars, okay? And so you'll never see it coming. Right. And that's why the thing we actually have to trust in now, and it's the hardest thing politically to do, is to actually to... You want to make America great? You got to make it great the way we always made it great, by being radically open.
Yeah.
Okay? Because when we're radically open, what happens? We get the signals first. We feel the heat and the changes first, and we attract the most high IQ risk takers. And this country, this city, and this valley down here, it was built by high IQ risk takers. And as long as we do that, I think we will it'll be okay. I do believe the transition is of this one is going to be really difficult, and that's why I want to work on my safety nets over here, and not just safety nets, but trampolines and education. But I think my friend Dov Seidman calls the human economy now that we're going into, you know, he says we've moved from hands to heads to hearts. I think that economy is going to be spilling out so many jobs in a country where the most prevalent disease is isolation. But I can't tell you what they are.
You talk about that transition in the context of horses and cars. You say the most dangerous time in New York's history was the advent of the car when we still had horses and buggies.
You did not want to be on the street then, right? You know, because you never knew where you were going to get hit.
And that's where we are.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of this inflection point, your perspective.
Yeah, I think we are. You know, I always tell people, Gavin, someone was alive when Gutenberg invented the printing press. Yeah. And some a monk said to some priest, you know, that's really cool. Okay. You mean I don't have to write these Bibles out longhand anymore? We just stamp them out? I kind of think we're at such a moment. But, you know, people always say, Friedman, you always think change, yada, yada. Yeah. You know, the world is flat. It's not flat. Tell me about it. Okay. You know, I'll stick with my analysis. I think something big is happening. I don't know whether it's the biggest all-time great. I don't know what it is. Right. I just know when you make connectivity fast, free, easy for you and ubiquitous, and you make complexity fast, free, easy for you and invisible, I can now with one touch on my phone page a car, pay the car, direct the car, and rate the driver with one touch. And we are abstracting complexity now everywhere, which you talked about, Gavin, now in grocery shopping. And that's happening everywhere. And I don't think that's a small thing.
And so in that context, does it require then, I imagine, we have to have a different kind of conversation than we're having on issues like education?
Absolutely.
You can't continue. I mean, you have that old line. You said you continue the old Texas saw, right? Continue to do what you've done, you get what you got.
Right,
no longer applicable, right?
Absolutely.
In a world where, quote unquote, average is over, something that's been a theme in many of your books, at least the last two books. You got to step up your game. It's the rise of the rest, et cetera. I mean, are you an advocate for reimagining a 21st century education system or just reforming in the existing education system, paving over the old cow path?
I think it's really got to be reimagined. My daughter works for the Khan Academy Lab School, you know, and I was talking to her over Thanksgiving about just things they're doing, very cutting edge. And their work is really focused on one thing. One principle she was explaining to me, ownership.
Yeah. Your favorite word.
My favorite word. I think it's the most,
important
word in the English
language.
Because where ownership exists, good things happen.
Yeah.
You know, I am a believer, you can put it on my tombstone, really. In the history of the world, no one has ever washed a rented car. I'm a big believer of that. In the history of all mankind, I know there's some knucklehead out there who washed a rented car, but I'm here to tell you that most normal people never wash a rented car. And where there is ownership in the room, where a kid owns their own education, where a teacher owns their classroom, where a community owns their streets, good things happen. You have self-propulsion. But where ownership isn't in the room, bad things happen.
You think we've lost a little of that? We're looking, it seems to me, we look for the guy or gal on the white horse to come save the
day. Exactly. Everybody wants the government to do it for me. Somebody come do it for me. And, you know, I understand, boy, that I can understand the fear and anxiety that people feel. And I live a privileged life. I'm not going to sit here and look down at people or whatnot. But I didn't do this in the sense that, these changes are much bigger than me. I've just tried to categorize them and optimize them. And I think we do people no favor by telling them that the government's going to fix it for you. You really have got to, you know, if in the 60s in Minnesota you needed a plan to fail, today you need a plan to succeed. And you got to update it every 6 months. That's why I like Reid Hoffman's book, The Startup of You. And everyone's got to think of themselves as their own startup. And you know, I say, when I graduated from college, I got to find a job. My girls had to invent a job. That's the big difference between us and them. And they got lucky, they find their first job, but to stay in the job, advance in the job, they have to invent, reinvent, and retool themselves more times. I've been at the New York Times 36 years. The chance of my girls working at the same place for 36 years, I probably would say, are zero. And I think the job of government, people who sit where you sit, are to enable people to take ownership, but not to do it for them, because that's a losing game. You can't keep up with it fast enough. But if people have ownership and you're giving them the tools, it's why in my Mother Nature's political party, one of the things I call for is making all post-secondary education tax deductible. Because if we're telling people you have to be a lifelong learner, but you have to earn $80,000 to pay $40,000 in tuition, that's just not on. You can't do that. Yep. So to me, all higher education should be tax deductible. And at the same time, if I could wave a magic wand and it would take this, I would pass a law that every BA has to be a maximum of 3 years. I went to graduate school at Oxford. Oxford does a BA in 3 years. The Technion in Israel does 3 years. If they can do it, why can't we? Why can't we give American parents a 25% reduction right off the top?
Yeah.
And so this higher education system we have is just, it can't last. But because they have oil, they have huge endowments many places, there, you know, wherever there's oil, there's trouble. And and because wherever there's oil, you can cushion yourself. You can cushion yourself from the pressure to change.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you think, I mean, I serve on the UC Regents, CSU Board. You think we're, in many respects, on a collision course of the future? You think we're no longer a monopoly in that respect?
Yeah, but also, again, you cannot tell people you have to be a lifelong learner, but you have to go in debt for half your career to pay for it.
Yeah.
That is unsustainable. And I don't know where the, again, AT&T partnering with Georgia Tech, $6,000 master's degree. In computer science. And the market is going to respond to this need.
Yeah.
And, you know, either you get ahead of it. You know, I always, one of my mottos in the world is flat, is whatever can be done will be done. The only question is, will it be done by you or to you? But just don't think it won't be done, okay? Because it will be done.
One of the things that struck me in this book, I mean, you talked about it at the end, and it's not just the last chapter. You talk about pluralism. You talk about being connected and the golden rule and family. Yeah. But it was throughout this book. You quote your friend Dove Simon about sustainable values versus situation. Right. I mean, there's a value laden. Yeah. I mean, this book, it struck me more than anything else. I mean, when was it obvious to you? I mean, when you're talking about sort of the hard sciences about globalization and technology changing, you know, and this notion of hyperconnectivity, all this, where you realize that it's time truly, not just, you know, thank you for being late, but truly time to pause and reconnect what you can't download. And that's that human connection you refer to.
Well, you know, the book really, I mean, some psychiatrists, you know, could put me on the couch, because really sort of what happened was I spent my first 30 years in journalism covering the Middle East, you know, and came to this city to talk about it often. And God, I really had some wonderful high points. I saw Oslo. I was in the White House lawn for that. I was in Cairo for the Arab Spring. And then it all kind of went bad. I hoped Iraq would work to produce a democracy there. It all went terrible. And I didn't know what to say anymore. So I came home. And then I watched America, and we were turning into Sunnis and Shiites. We just called them Democrats and Republicans, and people were saying, I would never let my kids marry one of them. And they were talking about someone of another party. So this tribalism that I saw there was getting recreated here. And so the real subtext of this book is, I said, I'm going to go back home. That I'm going to go back to the place where I was actually happiest, this community, and I'm going to really explore whether I just made it all up or it really was the place that I remember it. So I went back home and I interviewed all my high school teachers, many of them still alive, my friends, my community, and guess what? I didn't make it up. Things were better then, and I decided that the happiest time I've ever been in my life, I mean, outside of the wonderful marriage I have, is the time and place where I grew up. And I wanted to understand why that was so, because I wanted to share it with other people. And I'm just not interested in the Middle East anymore. And I'm actually not interested in Washington politics anymore. I actually hate it. I run away from it with my hair on fire. What I'm really interested in is the source of my optimism. And it's very easy to find in this country. Just stand on your head.
Yeah.
Because the country looks so much better from the bottom up than the top down.
Yeah.
And we have look, we have fractured communities. I don't have to tell you, Gavin, in the state, the problems in San Francisco and elsewhere. But there are they're just amazing people doing amazing things at the community level.
Yeah.
And I wrote this book to celebrate that, but because I just could see that the things that really mattered everywhere I went were actually the human-to-human things.
Yeah.
You know, I tell the story of a startup called LearnUp, and it's in from this area, and my friend Alexis Ringwald started. It's actually for helping people get jobs at these giant retailers. Because you apply to Walmart or Old Navy for a job, their whole HR system is to weed people out. Basically, go away, you know, because they get thousands and thousands of people applying. So LearnUp created a system where you actually have to take a two-hour exam in order to apply for a job. And you have to actually learn, do you know how to fold a shirt? Do you know how to operate a cash register? Do you know how to deal with a customer? It's amazing how many people don't. Just the prospect of an exam filters out a lot of people. If you take the exam and get through it, they actually make your work appointment for you, your application right. appointment for you. Your job interview. So I've gone to their site, and Alexis told me something very interesting. If you go to their dashboard, learnup.com, you'll notice in the corner there's a kind of smiley face. It's called the coach. Mm-hmm. Coach button. Coach button gets pushed more than any other button. And so in the book, I show all the questions the coach gets.
Yeah.
Coach, what should I wear to my interview? Coach, what if I'm going to be late? Coach, what do you think the first question will be? Turns out, Gavin, everybody needs a coach.
Yeah.
Okay? And so I also quote a study in the book by Gallup did about 5 years ago. They did a giant, Gallup does a lot of education polling. They did a study of 25,000 people who were out of college 4 or 5 years. I forgot the number. It's in the book. And they asked them, are you happy with the trajectory of your career? And they took all the people who said yes, and they broke them out and drilled down to see what they had in common. Well, the first thing they discovered was that where you went to college, Harvard, Yale, or UC Santa Barbara, mattered zero. There was zero correlation between where you went to college and whether you're happy with the trajectory of your career. They found these people had two things in common. One, they had had an internship in their area of interest somewhere along the way. Mm. Were they able to put hands-on a field to it? And the second, they had had a mentor somewhere along the way who took an interest in their hopes and dreams. So you tell me that if that's what determines people are happy in the workplace, how can that not be one of the next great careers or whatever, this human-to-human connection? And what I found was everywhere I went researching the book, it was that human-to-human thing
right.
that stood out. Can I just take the book for a second? Yeah. I want to just share one thing, and it really is my favorite passage in the book because it really summarized, and Gavin's marked up this book, and it's so great because he marked up just this paragraph on page 451, which I just want to share with people. This is from Thank You for Being Late. Don't get me wrong. Technology has so much to offer to make us more productive, healthier, more learned, and more secure. I'm awed by the intelligent assistance I discovered in researching this book and the potential it has to lift so many people out of poverty and discover talent and make it possible for us to actually fix everything. I'm hardly a technophobe, but we will get the best out of these technologies only if we don't let them distract us from making these deep human connections, addressing these deep human longings, and inspiring these deep human energies. And whether we do that depends on all the stuff you can't download. The high five from a coach, mm-hmm. the praise from a mentor, the hug from a friend, mm-hmm. the hand up from a neighbor, the handshake from a rival, the totally unsolicited gesture of kindness from the stranger, the smell of a garden, not the cold stare of a wall. And everything else is kind of just commentary for me. You know?
Yeah. I love it.
Thank you.
Now,
That, of course, would have been the perfect way to end, but
we got a few
more minutes.
Please.
So, but I like the theme, so I'm going to stick with it.
Great.
Know your audience. You said something the other day, and this is to do justice to all the questions people are asking about what just happened.
Sure.
Related to the presidential campaign. You said something about people wanting to feel protected.
Connected and respected. That's my friend Andy Karsner. Coined that in the book.
And that's an extension of what you were just saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
How do you feel that played out in this presidential life?
Well, you know, there's no question. You know, when I think about this election, you know, what are the things that really anchor us in the world? They're the community in which we live and the place where we work and the job that gives us identity and anchors us in the world. And I think these three accelerations have made some people feel that the changes in their community through immigration or other things happen just too fast for some people. It's not to defend it or not defend it. That's right. How they feel.
Right.
And I think a lot of people feel then they go to work and you just describe it again. Suddenly there's a robot sits down to them next to them and seems to be studying their job, you know. And both of these are happening at the same time. I go to the grocery store and there's someone there who doesn't speak my language and is wearing a head covering that doesn't look like a baseball cap. I personally like that. I celebrate that world. I'm really comfortable in it. But I understand why for some people that can happen too fast. As I say, and then I go to the office and I read the news that IBM Watson just co-wrote a song with Alex the Kid, and in 48 hours it went to number 4 on iTunes. And I think, whoa, what will there be for me? You know?
Yeah.
And so I wish I had an easy answer for it. I don't. But I also look back and say, wow, Obama just announced, or the Labor Party, we have 4.6% unemployment. So I'm not saying everything is good. Wages are clearly not going up at the rate, although actually now starting to go up. If you trust in America, keep the system open and do everything we can to give people the tools of education to own the startup of you, I think it's going to be okay. I certainly know it's going to be better than any alternative. And, you know, when President-elect Trump, he browbeats a single company in Indiana to keep 1,000 jobs. What he doesn't see is the 10,000 CEOs who say, whoa, I am not building my next factory in America. I don't want to be subject to that. And what he doesn't see is the 100,000 CEOs who then say, get me a robot. Okay. Because Trump can't, if I just fire these people, no one will see that. So I was telling Gavin, we're in the green room before, that in the middle of writing this book, I broke my shoulder. Never break your shoulder. Okay? The first thing you discover when you break your shoulder, it's connected to everything. Okay, I didn't know it was connected to my breast muscles and my fingers and my lower back and my middle back. And oh, my God. My friend Gary Shimano here even beat me at golf, you know, because of that. So,
the excuse. Yeah.
What we're doing right now, what Trump is doing, we're playing with big systems. The EU, I'm tired of it. Get rid of it. NATO, don't like it. Not going to pay for it anymore. China, Taiwan, U.S. security arrangement. 50 years it gave all three of us security and prosperity. I've had enough of it. Turns out Bob Dole took $140,000 from the Taiwanese government to lobby Trump on that. That story just came out.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
It's in the New York Times.
Wow. Wow.
So we're playing with big systems. Never play with big systems. You'll discover that, like your shoulder, they're connected to a million things you never knew.
Well, I mean, it's hard to end on that, but we're going to end on that.
You know, I have to tell you, because I actually can ruin any dinner party. And I do weddings and bar mitzvahs. So if you're... Well, you know, I'll tell you what,
let's end with the subtitle. If there's one, if you can just distill the essence of your optimism, and you have, you've touched on it. You've touched on it about resilience and pluralism, adaptability, all these. I mean, all the changes that you've seen, the social changes. But you've written something, you've gone to. And why don't we end with your own words?
Well, your book. It is a nice way to end it because I say somewhere in the book, you know, that you can't have grown up. If you grew up in the community I did, with the friends I did, with the parents I had, with right. the neighbors I had. Shame on you if you couldn't be an optimist. I went through elementary school, junior high, senior high, basically with the same group of kids. And yes, it wasn't very diverse. The diversity was, we were all predominantly white, but that's what it was. And now it's changing in a way I truly celebrate.
Yeah.
Shame on me. You know, I tell a story of my friend. I was home for a wedding back in Minneapolis. My friend Jay Goldberg. We're sitting at the table, and he tells me that his wife, we all grew up together, we've known each other for 50 years. I go home a lot because all my best friends are still from Minnesota and St. Louis Park. And he says, you know, Tom, my wife Eileen was driving on Highway 494 in Minneapolis today, and a guy almost drove her off the road. And she came home and said, Jay, I was so mad I almost honked. That is the definition of Minnesota nice, okay? Someone almost drove you off the road, and she almost honked. So let me end, Gavin, if I can, with where I end the book. And as I say, so let me truly end where I literally began. On a research trip back home in the summer of 2015, I drove by our old house in St. Louis Park at 6831 West 23rd Street, where my parents first moved from North Minneapolis in 1956. I hadn't done it for years, but decided on the spur of the moment to swing by. At one level, the old neighborhood's tightly packed rambler homes look remarkably the same as when I left mine for college and for work in the 1970s. Ours was still painted a light blue, but something also struck me as different, and I couldn't put my finger on it at first. My old neighborhood was totally familiar, but slightly unfamiliar. It took me a while to figure it out, and then it finally dawned on me, it was the trees. They were all small and scrawny when I was small and scrawny. Ours was a spanking new neighborhood when I grew up there, and now, a half century later, all the trees had grown tall and thick with long branches, and they were full of leaves, so much so that the neighborhood was considerably more shaded. The light had changed slightly, and it caught my eye because it contrasted with the much brighter mental image I had been carrying around for so long, like an old picture stuck in the back of my wallet. Those trees and I had both grown up and out from the same topsoil, and the most important personal, political, and philosophical lesson I took from the journey that is this book is that the more the world demands that we branch out, the more we each need to be anchored in a topsoil of trust that is the foundation of all healthy communities. We must be enriched by that topsoil, and we must enrich it in turn. That prescription is easier to write than to fill. But it is the order of our day, the real Uber task of our generation. It's so much easier to venture far, not just in distance, but also in terms of your willingness to experiment, take risks, and reach out to the other when you know that you're still tethered to a place called home and to a real community. Minnesota and St. Louis Park together were that place for me. They were my anchor and my sail. I hope this book will inspire you to pause in stride and find yours, and don't worry if it makes you late.
Thank you, Tom Freeman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to the audience and the audience at home, radio, TV, and the internet. I'll remind everybody that Tom's going to be he's going to be signing books, and the book is for sale. Let's not forget about that. And I ask you just very briefly, if you could, a few of you stay seated so we can give you a little bit more instructions about exactly where you can exit in the theater for the book signing. I'm Gavin Newsom, and now this meeting, the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you know, is adjourned.
Thanks, Gavin. That was just great.
Right. Thank you.